transcends the third dimension. BBSRadio.com embraces the fourth dimension, promotes natural alternative health, spreads joy. BBSRadio.com. Free energy, spirituality, honesty and truth. BBSRadio.com. Increase the vibration of the people and the planet. BBSRadio.com.
Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are and why we are here and what we may become. Thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived a disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Earth Explorers, welcome to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Eastern Washington State, and we're glad that you're here. Our AccuWindow forecast is about 78 degrees, light breeze out of the south. Very beautiful starlight tonight, I am sure. Phone lines will be open all night. U.S. toll-free, 888-228-4494. Anywhere in Canada, also toll free 877-489-6350. Anywhere else
on planet, off planet. If you can get to a cell phone tower, you can get to us. 530-776-5154 or 5185. And if you're listening to us and you want to call in on Skype, just use BBS Radio. And if you're a PalTalk user, you can reach us at bbsradio_com. We are coming to you live on channels 1 and 2 on BBS Radio. This is a three-hour program, so after the first hour, those of you that are listening on channel 1 need to switch over to channel 2. In the meantime, we are so happy that you are here and want you to join the ranks of BBS Radio late night. We're also coming to you live via the Steel Eye Media Network, courtesy of our friend Kevin Smith. So three different networks carrying us tonight. That's good. The solar wind is a mild 357.1 kilometers per second, and the proton count hasn't changed much since last week, 3.9 protons per cubic centimeter. Again, the sun is blank. Not a single sunspot from solar cycle 24. There was, however, a large prominence from the sun today, but nothing that will affect us here on Earth, unless you have a coronoscope and you can check that out. It is really, really breathtaking. I am going to break a story tonight in the second hour. I'm not going to do it in the first hour because I want to wait and make sure that you get your friends to listen in. You have about 60 minutes to call them up and get them online, because this is a piece of news that will rock the civilian world. It is news beyond anything factual you have heard in the last 10 years. So get going now. Start emailing, instant messaging, and calling your friends and telling them to tune in to X Squared Radio Live. It's free live. And I want to make sure that this news gets out to them. An independent armed service assessment panel in Huntsville, Alabama, has found that the lack of a true authority for U.S. military space acquisition has contributed to the overall decline of national space security, and is recommending sweeping changes within the Defense Department, a panelist said August 13th at the U.S. Space and Missile Defense Conference. The panel recommended an increase in the weaponization of space. More news on dark matter this week. By analyzing light from dwarf galaxies that orbit the Milky Way, scientists believe they have discovered the minimum mass for galaxies in the universe, 10 million times the mass of the Sun. This mass could be the smallest known building block of the mysterious invisible substance called dark matter. Stars that form within these building blocks clump together and turn into galaxies. Scientists know very little about the microscopic properties of dark matter, even though it accounts for approximately 5/6 of all matter in the universe. Quote, "By knowing this minimum galaxy mass, we can better understand how dark matter behaves, which is essential to one day learning how our universe and life as we know it came to be," said Louis Strigari, lead author of this study from the University of California, Irvine. Nice campus down there at UCI. Last week on X Squared Radio, we had Dan Willis on the program. He was one of the first and most powerful, credible witnesses for UFO activity observed by the military. He was a Navy code operator working in Alaska and had a very exciting call come in from a naval ship in distress. If you want to find out about that, go back to last week and listen to last week's archive. If you're not a member of the archives, you can easily subscribe just by clicking on the subscribe link at the homepage. That's the easiest way. It's really inexpensive, $2.50 if you want to just listen for 30 days, $20 if you want to listen for a whole year. And that just covers the cost of running the radio program. We don't do that as a profit center. If enough of you sign up, we'll lower the cost. We just want to cover the cost of operating and keep the word going out. This week, we have one of the most widely published astronomers in the world. He is the author of an amazing book, Dark Matter, Missing Planets, and New Comets, Paradoxes Resolved, Origins Illuminated. I read it, and I poked it full of Post-its. I read it a year ago, and I still refer to it. And I'm glad to have the author back on the program. Please welcome with me Tom Van Flandern. How are you, Tom?
Doing real well, Brooks. Thanks very much for that kind introduction.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You know, I have a day job, and I do engineering during the day. In fact, we've been grinding 3-inch black iron all day long, welding it up, trying to get the hot water loop going on this biodiesel plant we're building in Odessa. But what does an astronomer do for a day job?
Mostly sleep, but these days a heck of a lot of astronomy is done sitting in front of a computer screen, because a lot of the data that's coming in is coming in from space telescopes or spacecraft, and very little is observed directly with human eyes anymore, unless something unusual happens in our part of space.
Yeah, exactly right. I remember being a kid and living in Southern California. You make your way to Mount Palomar, which is, what is that? It's about a 200-inch telescope. It's really fantastic to look through. But that was before digital cameras. So now the science has completely changed. As you said, you can almost observe the stars 24 hours a day now.
That's right, and we observe them not just their light, but we now observe them in ultraviolet, in X-rays, in gamma rays, and at the far end of the spectrum, we observe their heat or infrared emissions, microwave, radio emissions. So we're getting views of the sky at all these different wavelengths, and we do that for the entire universe, and then we have corresponding to each of these space telescopes that are out there in the near-Earth environment. We send a lot of probes out through the solar system where we've done flybys of planets, moons, comets, asteroids, and interesting objects, and in several cases landed. And, of course, in the ultimate triumph so far, we've sent men to the moon. But we've actually landed a robotic spacecraft on 6 different astronomical bodies now, and we're getting a wealth of data, a lot of it quite surprising and quite different from the theories that were in vogue before the real data came in.
Well, what's some of the top 3 myth-busting that's going on in astronomy right now?
Oh, let's see. Boy, it'd be hard to arrange them in order, but probably the one that's going to have the most consequences all through astronomy and physics has got to be the speed of light paradigm going down. We've had 100 years now of the notion that the speed of light was an absolute speed limit for the universe, and nothing could go faster than that, at least in forward time, and that any attempts to do that would just meet ever more resistance.
We've heard that the speed of light is the ultimate limit, and as you approach it, time slows down and inertia becomes asymptotic, and you can't go any faster. But now, you know, I've had physicists on this program in the last 90 days that fortified that theory. What is breaking open, or what's been rediscovered now with empirical data that's beginning to change that?
There are big changes on both the theoretical and observational front. The beginning of the clues that something was terribly wrong began back in the 90s when we got the results from a number of experiments, some of which we'd known about before, but they'd been sort of force-fitted to the model that things couldn't go faster than light. But as more data came in, the force-fitting got weirder and weirder, and we now know that gravity is a force of nature which cannot be limited to the speed of light, because there are some flat-out phenomena that occur with gravity where their communication between a source mass and a target body is occurring much faster than the speed of light would allow. For example, from the sun to the earth, light takes 8.3 minutes to get here, or to travel that 93 million miles. As fast as light is, that's a long distance. But and as a result of that delay, the sunlight itself is displaced on the sky against the background stars, because as Earth orbits the sun, it looks to us, thinking of ourselves as stationary, as though the sun is moving through the background stars relative to us through the constellations of the zodiac, Aries, Taurus, Gemini, and so on, in a once-a-year trip. Well, as a result of that 8-minute delay, we see the sun against the background stars where it was 8.3 minutes ago.
Right.
Because the light took that long to get here. However, the gravity from the sun pulling us directly toward where the sun is right now, and with no delay of 8.3 minutes.
Well, so let me ask you the classic question, and I've gotten all kinds of answers to this. What if the sun just suddenly disappeared from the solar system? It just blinked out. How long would it take for the Earth, gravitationally speaking, to discover that it's gone?
Okay, the very short answer is a tiny fraction of a second. But the answer needs more explanation, because in the theory of gravity that's now in vogue, the theory of general relativity by Einstein, there is something called a gravitational field, which is a bit different than the force of gravity. And this gravitational field, which technically is a gravitational potential field, can be thought of, relativists don't think of it this way, but in modern physics we've learned to think of this gravitational potential field as a kind of material medium that fills space through which light can propagate, and it's the force of gravity makes it denser near large masses like the sun. So if you have a light-carrying medium that gets denser as you approach a mass, and then if you put a light beam through that, the light beam will bend by refraction. And that was one of the proofs that Einstein's theory was right, that light bends and the light redshifts and the light is delayed in propagation. All of those effects are just courtesy of this light-carrying medium changing density as it approaches a mass.
Right.
But those are not directly being caused by gravity. They're just indirectly being caused by gravity, because the gravitational force is what makes the medium denser near masses. The direct effect of gravity that keeps things in orbit, that is the thing that must propagate very much faster than the speed of light, even though those other effects do happen only at the speed of light. So when it comes to your question, what would happen if the sun disappeared right now? The answer is the sun's gravitational field would take 8 minutes, 8.3 minutes, to dissipate out at this distance. So starlight would keep bending and redshifting and slowing for 8.3 minutes after the sun ceased to exist. But the sun's gravitational tug on the Earth would cease immediately, and Earth would leave its roughly circular orbit and continue from the first second right out on a straight line.
So the light that was bending because of the gravitational force of the sun, 8.3 minutes later would arrive where the Earth was, because the Earth is going to be tangentially traveling straight out into space as a free-floating planet.
With the exception of one word in there, I would agree. The bending isn't caused directly by gravitational force. It's caused by refraction.
Oh, right, right, right.
And that's because the light-carrying medium is still there for 8 minutes. So there is a delay in that going away, but there is no delay in the force on the Earth going away, or any other force from gravity going away. But the light-carrying medium, the gravitational potential field, would take 8 minutes to dissipate out to the Earth's distance. We have an animated graphic of showing both these effects at the same time out at our website, which would be interesting for perhaps some of your viewers to drop by sometime.
Yeah, we have a link to it at X Squared Radio, but go ahead and give out the link now so people can, if they're listening now, they can go ahead and click to it and actually watch that animation. It's pretty cool.
Yes, the website is metaresearch.org, and I don't remember the precise link through the chain to get to that page, but you would at our homepage, you would click on the cosmology tab and then the gravity sub-tab. The quickest way to get to the animation is to click on our media and links tab, and then the animation sub-tab. We have all the animations summarized in that one place. And you'll see in the left column, one of the animations is what would happen if the sun suddenly vanished. There's a caption and then the animation itself showing the effects I just described with the Earth taking off immediately, but the bending of starlight persisting for 8 minutes.
Now, this is kind of not really opposing a general relativity, at least Einsteinian relativity, but there are other relativities out there. I don't know if Lorentz was a contemporary, but he was widely published, and I guess there just wasn't enough empirical data at the time. And maybe, I don't know if Lorentz was involved in military operations or military research or not in his day. But this is Lorentzian relativity, right?
Yes, that's right. One of the early things we discovered when the experiment started showing that certain phenomena, such as gravity, can propagate faster than the speed of light in forward time, which seems to be a direct contradiction of special relativity, is that actually special relativity is not all that well established as is usually advertised. Physicists are fond of saying, well, it's passed 11 independent experiments and is looking golden. But it turns out that Lorentz's relativity, which was published a year before Einstein's, and is sometimes called relativity for the ether, that theory passed the same 11 independent tests. So the two were kind of on an equal footing until these new experiments came in. And they have the same mathematics, by the way. But the big difference is that Lorentz's theory has no speed limit, whereas Einstein's does. And the physical reason for that is, in Einstein's theory, when you go at a high speed, as you remarked earlier, time slows down. But in Lorentz's theory, when you go at a high speed, your clock will slow down, but nothing happens to time. Time is just a measure of change in the universe, and it's always the same for all observers everywhere. And that was an important philosophical difference between Einstein's and Lorentz's views of how the world works. And it's interesting that here we are, almost a century, well, fully a century later, since those theories came out in 1904 and 1905, respectively, we're finding out that Lorentz's vision was actually more on target than Einstein's, and things like the global positioning system, where we have atomic clocks in orbit, all different orbits going in different directions at different relative speeds. The system had to be set up according to Lorentz's prescription for how to set the clocks and not Einstein's, because Einstein's systems led to large corrections that were time-dependent and different depending on which observer was making them.
Yeah, whereas, exactly. Where you are on the Earth.
Yes, that made the GPS system so complex that half the physicists were polled before GPS was launched said the system would never work. But they wind up using Lorentz's prescription for a universal time, and all the clocks on all the satellites are simultaneously synchronized with them, with each other and with all the ground clocks on Earth, and the system works beautifully and very simply.
That's why the jet lands in Newark when it takes off from Amsterdam every single time. That's pretty cool. So that's kind of real world, how it affects us. A lot of people say, oh, gee, you know, why worry about all these physicists? You know, what are they? Got their head up in the stars and blah, blah, blah. But every time you get onto an airplane, and nowadays every time you get on a cruise ship, because now those are navigated automatically by GPS, you are taking advantage of something that's not so Einsteinian, but Lorentzian. So very cool. Now, does this mean, I know we talk about the sound limit, you know, the speed of sound limiting air flight for, well, as long as man was flying, until we figured out how to compress the atmosphere and shove it out the back of a ramjet to push a craft faster than sound. It's pretty routine now, but how far are we away from compressing gravity and shoving it out the back of some dimensional engine to achieve the kinds of speeds that must be necessary to cross the vastness of space?
Well, don't we wish we had a way to predict the rate at which future discoveries will occur. But the beginning of getting onto the right path is to clear out the old physics where it went off course, and bring back a simpler, clearer physics that sets us again on the right path towards such discoveries. And the key, I would think, to achieving practical, faster than light travel with spacecraft, or at least with communications, is being able to harness what we call gravitons, the carriers of gravitational force, the things that must be, travel probably billions of times faster than the speed of light. And to do that, since these gravitons penetrate almost anything we know of today, they can fly right through the Earth most of the time without hitting anything. It's only a small percentage of them that actually interact with matter and reduce the force of gravity. In order to be able to harness them and manipulate them and use them for propulsion, or even just more simply for communications, we would have to create states of matter so dense that they could block gravitons. So condensed matter physics is the future to going where you just described we'd all like to go. And my best guesstimate is that we are at least a couple of generations, perhaps more realistically 100 years away from where we could achieve something like warp drive and start bringing about the fabulous Star Trek scenario.
So the driver, the amplifier, has to be some exotic material of neutron-style density, neutron star density, to be able to block the gravitons. Are all the gravitons the same frequency? Are they like, I know they're a subatomic. Are they a particle? Are they a string? Are they you know, just a frequency, a wave?
Well, again, we're turning to experiments. Gravitational force exhibits no wave properties, but it does have particle properties. So we suspect that these hypothetical gravitons are indeed particles, but not just subatomic. That somehow doesn't cover it. They're way below by a factor of tens of thousands to millions below the smallest quantum particles that we know of today. And so they're very tiny, very fast, as I said, billions of times faster than the speed of light, and very, they're so small that matter and graviton interactions are very infrequent relatively. So there's the only reason why gravity is as strong a force as it is because the universe is flooded with these tiny things. So there are more than enough of them to make up for the fact that the interactions with matter are infrequent.
It would have to be a cumulative effect, you know, just the fact that there's, like you said, the universe is flooded with them, that they constructively interfere with one another and add to one another's presence to where, you know, ordinarily a neutrino-sized particle could pass through about a light year of Earth without hitting anything because Earth isn't very dense. But when you take a whole bunch of them, the incidence of collision then become really interesting.
That's precisely right, and right on target. And the gravitons are even smaller in cross-section than neutrinos. So what this leads us to is a beautiful and simple picture of the physics behind the gravity in our present theories of gravity. We don't have to change the math at all again, but the physics changes. And in this view, with the universe being filled with these flux of very fast-moving gravitons coming from all directions, the reason that the apple falls from the tree is because more gravitons are hitting it from above than from below, because the Earth blocks some from getting through from the below. The result is an imbalance. The apple falls down. Any two objects in space would shadow each other from some gravitons, and the result would be an apparent force of attraction, but is actually a force of push toward one another. And hence the name that has now become into vogue, pushing gravity. It seems like an oxymoron at first, almost a contradiction, because gravity is what we think of as an attractive force. But in this view, we're held to the Earth by a rain of gravitons coming down on us from above rather than from something coming out of the Earth and pulling us down.
Well, that raises some really interesting paradoxes, because if we're talking about shielding two bodies, obviously the area of the two bodies that face each other don't have any gravitons between them because they're shadowing them, but that would assume that the gravitons are somehow all heading into the space between those two planets from both sides, and that's why the planets are pushed together. And they don't originate from the space in between the two planets, so hence they're not pushed apart. So where are the gravitons going to? Are they just going everywhere?
Well, going everywhere is the answer. They're like a very super large-scale version of Earth's atmosphere. If you're up in the middle of the atmosphere, you have air molecules coming at you with very high speeds from all directions, and you're just sitting there in the middle being bombarded from all sides, and you feel pressure from the air molecules. Well, it's like that in space, where you're getting bombarded with gravitons from all sides, and you feel pressure, but if there are two objects in space, they shadow each other from some impacts. As long as the gravitons don't collide with each other inside the space between two bodies and scatter, because then they would push outward as often as they push in.
The total collisions on those two objects would be less in between them than they are everywhere else, and so the net result is to push the two objects together.
Precisely so, and that ties in with something else that's already been mentioned tonight in your prologue, which is dark matter. It turns out that the mean free path of a graviton before it hits another graviton works out to be a distance of, in the astronomers' units, it's about 2,000 parsecs, which is, let's see, about roughly 6,000 light years, 6,000 times the distance light travels in a year, or about 6,000 times the about 2,000 times the distance from our sun to the nearest star. That's quite a long way for gravitons to travel before they hit each other. But over those very large distances, they do start hitting one another, and then they start backscattering. So if you have two galaxies, or even two stars in one galaxy that are more than 6,000 light years apart, the backfilling from the gravitons hitting each other means that the force which they would normally be pushed toward each other is lessened by the scattered gravitons between them pushing back, and so it's a reduced force. And this means that the law of gravity in the for very large scales is going to change from its inverse square character to inverse linear, and
a big difference.
That's a giant difference, and the plain practical impact of that is it explains why the law of gravity has appeared to change in galaxies and for stars orbiting a single galaxy in such a way as to force the astronomers to imagine, since they trust the law of gravity, that there must be invisible dark matter out there to fix things up so that the law of gravity still works. Well, this answer is, there's no such thing as dark matter. Instead, it is a natural process for any law of physics that the force carriers, once you reach the range where they can hit one another, the nature of the force law changes just the way that is observed.
Right. Right. The kinetic energy is transferred from one to another, and it's instantaneous. Wow. Wow. That's fascinating. We were sitting around the table the other night, and sometimes we talk about the greatest inventions that have ever been discovered. I was going to say created, but I guess we just discover things. And the other thing was we talked about two things. One was the formation of planets, and then somewhere in the menu, we started discussing Newtonian physics. We were talking about Newton's theory of gravity and thin crusts for spheres, and how his theory for gravity inside of planets is just thin sphere physics added one on top of the other, an infinite number of thin spheres. So I want to approach the first one first, because we were talking about the formation of planets, and one of the observations that came up was, do planets explode? And I noticed you had that question on your website, so I thought you might be prepared to answer that for us tonight, because I know they're listening. Do planets explode?
Yes, there is another area of current research. The story dates back 200 years, of course, to when the astronomers drew attention to the fact that there were four inner planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, and then a big gap, and then four, and Neptune wasn't discovered until 1845, but that became the fourth of the large gas giant planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And between the two sets of four was this big gap where there was room for one additional planet. And instead, in 1801, they discovered the first of the minor planets, of which there are over 100,000 known today, bits of rock and debris that almost immediately there were two theories. They either had to be a planet trying to form that couldn't get itself together, or a planet that exploded. And those two theories have been back and forth, in and out of vogue over those 200 years until our times. And the failure to accrete theory was dominant until around the mid-70s, when suddenly some substantial new evidence came in that it had to be an explosion. And that evidence has gotten stronger and stronger, and in the most recent publication of that, we essentially have collected all known evidence about the solar system, including the many predictions made over the last 30 years by the exploded planet hypothesis that are unmatched by the alternative theory, to the effect that not only do planets explode routinely as an end state for their lives after billions of years, but it appears that if we look at all the evidence, our solar system originally had six more major planets and probably several more moons than it has today. And so we've lost a substantial fraction of our planets already to explosion. And then the next question is...
If one thinks about it, for a while... And you think about how planets are formed, if they do form from these accretion disks. They start out rotating very, very slowly because the dust is scattered, you know, hither and yon. But as the radius begins to collapse, these things begin spinning faster and faster, like an ice skater.
Mm-hmm.
And so they could, you know, reach a point at which they're just spinning so fast they don't have enough gravity to stay together, and some sudden event occurs, and wham!
Well, what you just described is something else that has also seen a resurgence of interest recently. It's called the fission theory, which basically says that, yes, as stars and planets evolve, they do contract as they accrete matter or cool, either one. And they, that makes them spin up, and they eventually overspin, and stars would then shed planets, and rapidly spinning planets would shed moons, and the result is what's called the fission theory for the formation of planets and moons. But that's a different process than explosions, which are, for one thing, from the evidence that we get from the orbits of comets and asteroids, they must have been the result of an explosion that began in the center of the planet and moved outward, and not something that occurred at or near the surface.
So a little bit like, you know, gravity begins to smash into a smaller and smaller space, and then fissionable elements are driven into supercriticality, and you literally get a nuclear bomb on the inside of the planet.
Yes, that's very similar to one of the three current theories for why planets explode. There is some evidence for something very much like that, but nuclear energy is not really sufficient to blow up big planets. However, this graviton model I just mentioned means that these gravitons are capable of depositing enormous amounts of energy in bodies in a very short time scale, and what keeps large masses such as planets and stars stable is that they radiate a lot of heat back into space. One of the mysteries about the major planets for a long time has been why they're radiating more heat into space than they take in from the sun. Jupiter, for example, radiates more than twice as much heat as it takes in. Gravitons, we think, may be the answer to that why question, and that as long as the planet keeps shedding the excess heat it takes in, everything is stable. But if, say, precipitated by a collapse, a heat barrier is created, a very dense layer of matter that the heat can't penetrate, then you're going to reach critical energy in very little time, a fraction of a second, and the planet would blow.
Wow. So we're talking about another source for global warming.
Well, again, Earth, thankfully, is in thermal equilibrium. Earth is only emitting back into space about, if I don't remember what the number is in calories per square meter or anything useful, but whatever it is, the heat that comes into the Earth from the sun and goes back into space, the Earth itself emits about 1/1,000th more than that into space, and that's attributed to radioactivity within the Earth.
I got you. Okay.
Radioactivity, okay, though, is probably just another manifestation of graviton heating, but the point is that for Earth, a relatively stable planet, it's a very small contribution, not enough to affect global warming. The good news is that it means explosions are not in our future for at least hundreds of millions of years, if not billions.
Yeah, I'm down with that. I would rather not see that happen, but it does, you know, make you scratch your head because you look at our solar system and you go, okay, there are, you know, 10 orbitable bands, but one of them isn't a planet. It's just junk. It's just a ring of large rocks, and some of them are quite large. I mean, you know, large enough to be considered small planets, certainly bigger than what you would consider an asteroid, and some of them revolve slowly enough that, you know, they're coated along with all other slow-rotating bodies in our solar system, so we kind of know everything's been in the neighborhood during, well, I guess the last time you were on this program, we talked about the black axiom. Maybe in the next, you know, 5 or 10 minutes, you could explain to our listeners what the black axiom is, and maybe the general neighborhood in the galaxy or in the universe that it exists, and the possibility that maybe in 2012 we're heading back for that that region.
Okay. Well, that mixes.
It mixes a lot of stuff.
yeah, it'll be an interesting stew when that's all mixed up. But let's see. Let's start with the Earth. When one of these planets exploded, and we think the last major planet explosion was 65 million years ago, what happened on Earth at that time? Apparently, a number of these asteroids slammed directly into Earth from the explosion. We have now counted 16 craters, and it seems like another one is discovered every year or two, that date from 65 million years ago, which is, in geology, a significant epoch, because at 65 million years ago, the Earth underwent some tremendous cataclysm, and it's called a mass extinction event for life. The dinosaurs were all killed off. That's the most famous evidence. But actually, 70% of all species, that means 100% of the members of 70% of the species on Earth were killed during whatever that catastrophic event was. There were at least 16 major craters, not just the one that's usually touted at Chicxulub. There were changes in the atmosphere and oceans. There was a single global fire. There was radioactivity. There was a massive volcanic eruption, unequaled in any time since then, that had lava flowing out for thousands of miles from the place where the crust was punctured. It was a dreadful, fearful time to be on Earth, and we're lucky that life survived at all. But that was the result of one of these planet explosions, we now think, peppering the Earth. But that's the effect here. Now, if we look around the solar system, interestingly, there dating they've done on lunar rocks shows that something also happened to the moon at the same time. So whatever it was on Earth, unless it was a mighty peculiar coincidence, it must have been from out there and not something that had just happened down here and nowhere else.
Exactly.
But if we watch the explosion in our minds take place, the first thing that happens is this blast wave spreads out through the solar system. And although we think of an explosion as pretty much an instant affair, the distances in space are so great that we're talking about weeks or months for this blast wave to spread and get any place. So it was probably about a month for it to reach Earth from the explosion, and probably anywhere between 2 to 6 weeks for it to reach, say, Jupiter or Saturn. Well, it's interesting then, looking at the effect on the other bodies in the solar system. One of the moons of Saturn is particularly interesting in this regard because it's a very snowy, icy, bright satellite called Iapetus. And it's one of the brightest and most reflective objects in the outer solar system for its size, just because it's so snowy bright on one half of its surface.
Right.
The other half of its surface is coal black, a difference of 10 in reflectivity, with this black material all over one hemisphere and streaked near the edges of that hemisphere as if something had blasted onto that moon. Now, what makes Iapetus special is that it was the only object out there with essentially no atmosphere to speak of that rotates so slowly that the blast wave could have only captured it on a little over one side, because it takes over 80 days, about 80 days, to rotate once. So the blast wave catches it on one side, and the other side is protected from the blast wave, and that's just what we see. For that one object that has this slow rotation, we see icy bright on one side, blasted backside with lots of cratering. And then there's another moon in the outer solar system where the polar axis is tipped over enough that one axis would have been facing toward the blast along with the rotating moon, but the other axis and its polar region would have been permanently facing away from the blast as the blast wave went by. And sure enough, one polar region is bright and the other one is black. So the black axiom is basically saying all through the solar system, to the extent that solid surfaces, ices, atmospheres and so on will allow, we see evidence from a blast wave going through the solar system just to the extent that we would predict would happen, and don't need to invoke separate histories for each of these objects to explain why they have the irregular markings that they have.
Right, right. And when you look at, you know, slow rotating bodies in the solar system, and they have this evidence that, you know, something, the universe or the solar system passed through something, and the fast rotating thing has got a universal coating, and the slow rotating thing has got a half spray painting of it. There's empirical evidence to back it up, but how many times has it happened? And what about our own moon? I mean, our own moon revolves, you know, relative to the sun once every 28 days, so it rotates pretty smoothly. Is it half coated as well?
Well, one of the interesting things about the moon is that it has two very different sides to it. The side that we see has these what are called mare, because they that's the word for sea, the Latin word. The ancients thought they were seas, but actually they are just very dark, smooth areas where, that resulted from lava flows from giant impacts. So most of the giant impacts did occur on one side, and the other side was relatively protected from them. But we think that that was from one of the earlier explosions early in the solar system's history, and that the more recent explosion in the month's time that it took the blast wave to get here, much of the blast wave black material would have been dropped all over the moon. And indeed, the moon is very dark almost all over its surface, reflecting only 7% of the light that reaches it. It's
right.
Revealing to look at some of these spacecraft photographs that show the Earth and the moon in the same field of view. The Earth is so bright compared to the moon, it's hard to believe that you're talking about the objects at the same distance of the sun reflecting the same sunlight, because the Earth
exactly.
is so, the moon is so non-reflective. It's coated all over with this dark material. And when the astronauts picked up some of this material, it looked sort of normal brightness to them while they were standing on the moon, and then they brought it back to Earth and compared to things on Earth and the light here, it looked extremely black. They were quite surprised by the difference in appearance.
That is amazing. That is really amazing. I want to remind you, Earth Explorers, that those of you that are listening on Channel 1, you're going to need to switch to Channel 2 during this break, because Channel 1 is, of course, the daytime BBS radio, and Channel 2 is the late night. So we want to try to introduce you to the late night hosts, beginning with X Squared Radio on Sunday nights. So you're going to have to switch over to Channel 2 at this break. We'll leave the phone lines on. Toll free U.S. 888-228-4494. Toll free Canada 877-489-6350. And anywhere else on planet, off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us at 530-776-5154. Also, those of you that are using Skype, lots of Skype users out there, it's just BBS Radio and Pal Talk, BBSRadio_com. We're going to take about a 4-minute break here, and we will be back with more of Tom Van Flandern, and we're going to go places well past your imagination, so please come back in about 4.5 minutes. With more of X Squared Radio. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived a disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They have come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. That have switched over from Channel 1 to Channel 2, welcome back. Hopefully you have called all of your friends and told them that there is going to be a news release this hour, because I'm I'm going to give you some news about a military program that's at least going to blow your mind and probably going to confirm some suspicions that you have had. Oxygen is constantly leaking out of Earth's atmosphere and into space. Measurements taken by satellites during the 1980s and 1990s show the escaping ions were traveling faster the higher they were observed. This implied that some sort of acceleration mechanism was involved. Now, new work on data collected by a group of formation flying satellites called Cluster shows that Earth's own magnetic field is accelerating the oxygen away. But don't panic, because there's plenty to go around. However, in the far future, when the sun begins to heat up in old age, the balance might change and the oxygen escape might become significant. So, that being said, we still have a long way to go before any of that begins. This is a 3-hour program, so if you're not getting all 3 hours, make sure to mark it down on your calendar, and also let us know who your affiliate is, and we'll contact them and take care of the rest. Now, here's a piece of news. The F-33 fighter jet has come through tests and is ready for deployment. It is going to be deployed in Mountain Home, Idaho. This jet is very unique. You might think that you know about the F-33. You might even have a prospective Revell model out there, a la F-117 stealth fighter that was supposedly so secret, but Revell released a model of the thing before the public even knew about it. However, this jet is very unique. There's not much talk of its performance because it is powered by a nuclear thrust unit that remains hush-hush. Also, and this is it, fresh from my source inside of NORAD. This is not retired NORAD. This is active duty NORAD. The Air Force has also reached the 10-year point in the operation of a plane that routinely flies to the moon and back. That's right. You heard me. This vehicle flies from the surface of Earth to the far side of the moon and returns to Earth on a routine, if not regular, basis. My source is accurate. Believe me. So now you can start your chat lines and you can send out your blanket emails to all of your conspiracy friends. We don't do conspiracy theories here. Nothing but actual research and as close to the facts as we can get them right here. Now, that's not saying we don't explore. That's what we're all about. But we don't rumor. So that is accurate. Phone lines are open. Toll free U.S. 888-228-4494. Anywhere toll free Canada 877-489-6350. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, you can reach us. If you can get to a cell phone tower, it's 530-776-5154. Or if you're using Skype, it's simply BBS Radio and Pal Talk. All you have to do is put in BBSRadio_com. And don't forget that the Ark of Millions of Years came out July 2nd, and it climbed the charts much, much faster than we thought it was going to. That's the third book in the trilogy, the Ark of Millions of Years series, about 1,500 pages worth. All three books now have the new cover. So if you're thinking about a Christmas present for one of your avid Earth Explorer friends and they don't have a copy yet, we are going to have special pricing for the trilogy together as a boxed set. We're limiting the orders to 500, so you're going to have to order early because we ran through that in about a day and a half when Volume 3 came out. So we're going to have special pricing on it. We're going to put it on the website next Sunday. So if you want to find out what the new price is, start packing away your quarters so that you can make your purchase. It'll be at x2-radio.com at the online store, and we will send out to all of our newsletter subscribers the box set price, and it's going to be a good value. And if you only own one copy, it'd be a good time to pick up the other two copies. And Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Borders, Walden Books, they're not going to sell this box set. If you buy the books from them, you're going to be paying for each individual book, and you're not going to get them autographed. But if you buy the box set from us, they will come autographed, and you will also be, whoever you give the gift to, give us their email address, and we'll provide the audio books for volumes 1 and 2 via a downloadable link. And that way they can have 58 hours of reading already done for them. So if they're not great readers, don't worry about it. I read it for you. And they can just listen along. My guest tonight is Tom Van Flandern. He is the author of a large book, and it is comprehensive. In the sense that it's everything you ever wanted to know about cosmology. And if you haven't read any books on the formation or the behavior of the universe, this is the great first book to pick up. It's called Dark Matter, Missing Planets, and New Comets, Paradoxes Resolved and Origins Illuminated. I added the "and" for clarity there. I read it, and I've poked it full of Post-its, and I've got notes in the margins. That's my favorite book on astronomy. And, Tom, you have an event coming up, right? A conference up here in Port Angeles, Washington. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, that's true, Brooks. The event is about cosmology, because the current theory of cosmology called the Big Bang Theory that's been around for about 80 years and has been the dominant theory for about the last 40 years has come into big trouble big time. The idea behind the Big Bang was basically that as we look out into the universe and we see other galaxies of billions of stars, just like our Milky Way galaxy with its 200 billion stars in it, those galaxies have light that is redshifted, which usually means it's moving away from us. And the further away the other galaxies are, the more their light is redshifted, which in the simple explanation would mean the faster they're moving away from us. And that led to the Big Bang Theory. The first thought was, well, gee, if everything's moving away from us, it must have been together at one time and there must have been a big explosion to get things started. But astronomers rebelled at the idea of putting the Earth back in the center of the universe.
Yeah, that would mean everything is blowing away from us. That means we were at ground zero, doesn't it?
That's right, that's right. So instead, they came up with what's called the Big Bang Theory. And in the Big Bang Theory, we're supposed to think of an inflating balloon. And this balloon has, let's say, dimes taped to its surface here and there. And then as the balloon inflates, the dimes get further apart from one another. All the dimes, all over the surface of the balloon, get further apart from each other without any motion of on the part of the dimes. It's just because there's now more balloon between each pair of dimes. And so the Big Bang Theory is the three-dimensional analog of that for space. In the Big Bang Theory, the galaxies are not moving through space. Instead, more space is constantly being created between all the galaxies as the universe expands, and none of those galaxies is at the center, none is at the edge. It's just all galaxies are getting further apart from one another because of the new space constantly being added. And that's our lovable Big Bang Theory that comes down to us today.
I seem to remember in the book Gravitation, it's a big black, you know, family Bible-sized book that people have on their coffee table if you're really into this kind of stuff. And I think it was on like page 546. It shows this theory of the expanding universe and with the balloon. And it actually has an animated, a cartoon character that's blowing up the balloon. And I always wanted to know, who's the guy blowing the balloon up?
Indeed. Yes, it does require a few leaps of imagination, not the least of which is how you go from expanding surface of a balloon to expanding in three dimensions without expanding into a fourth, which is what they claim. It takes a lot of imagination to consider the Big Bang and even more to accept it. Well, the observational evidence has recently taken on an alarming character for the cosmologists.
Well, what are the high priests of cosmology thinking now?
Well, in the year 2000, they were very happy because the direct evidence that the universe was expanding had been very iffy, and a lot of it had been shot down before 2000. And then in the year 2000, they discovered that they could see supernovas in distant galaxies quite far away. And as you mentioned earlier, according to the theory of relativity, if something is very far away, therefore expanding away from us very fast, there ought to be this slowing down, and so the supernova, if it normally would take 30 days for its light to rise and fall, it would take longer according to how far away it was. And they saw exactly that kind of effect, and they said, aha, That proves the universe is expanding. At last we have proof. Well, that euphoria lasted only 5 years, and then 3 years ago, astronomers realized that something that's been known for the last 100 years, a little effect called Malmquist bias, had to be figured into the equation. And I'll explain briefly what Malmquist bias is. If you have things out in the universe like stars or galaxies or supernovas or quasars or anything that comes in small, medium, and large, typically there's an average size. Let's say we're talking about supernovas now. So there's an average size supernova, and the size tells you the brightness and the time it takes the light curve to rise and fall. So there are a lot of the average size ones, and the ones that are extremely large compared to average or extremely small compared to average are relatively rare.
Right.
It's, for those familiar with it, it's called a normal distribution curve, which is a curve that's nearly flat at the beginning, rises to a peak, and then falls off again and goes flat. So most of the action is in the middle. Now, as you look further out into the universe, the further you look, the bigger and bigger your sample of objects is going to be, because when you look twice as far away as before, you're looking at 8 times the volume. And if you look 10 times further away than before, you're looking at 1,000 times the volume. So you expect to see lots more samples, and with so many samples, you expect to see more extremes on the bright end and on the faint end.
Right, but you expect the mean to stay roughly the same.
You expect the mean to stay roughly the same. But now comes the bias part, Malmquist bias. As you start getting out to some distance, you start losing the faint ones. You can't see them anymore because they're faint.
Right.
And if you get out to an even greater distance, you start losing even the average ones, and at the greatest distances, all you can see are the really bright ones. So when you apply that correction for the fact that your sample is biased, the further out you go, the more you're seeing not the average anymore, but something skewed toward the bright end of the sample, then you expect necessarily that since the bright ones rise and fall much more slowly than the average ones, you necessarily expect that there will be some slowing of the observations, and when you correct for this known effect, and it's not optional to correct or not correct, it has to be corrected for, when you apply that correction, there is nothing left over for expansion of the universe. In other
so
words,
that kind of supports the idea that the universe is static, not expanding.
That's right. It is fairly conclusive evidence that the universe is not at all expanding. And this has led to this and one of the other crucial pillars of the Big Bang called the microwave radiation, which also has fallen in the last few years. I can explain that in a few minutes if you like, but just to give
sure.
you the overview, the two big pillars of the Big Bang, the expansion and the microwave radiation, have both fallen, proving that the Big Bang cannot be a correct theory, and that adds to about 60 different scientific arguments that have arisen over the last 15 years that are called the list of problems with the Big Bang. It doesn't do this, it contradicts that. The need to invent dark matter, the need to invent dark energy, and other inventions just to keep the theory viable at all, long list of problems, and the whole panoply has now come down to where in 2004, a group of cosmologists said, enough. The theory is obviously in trouble. There's a problem with the skewing of the funding, because only research into Big Bang-related ideas is being funded, and they signed a petition or a statement saying, we think it's time to end the skewing of the funding and to take a very serious look at the problems with the Big Bang and what the best alternatives might be.
That's a shame that is how it works in science. People say, oh, well, you have science on one side and you have religion on the other. I can tell you from my own personal experience in the industry, there is a religion science, too, and there are high priests and there's, you know, a council of the 12, as it were, and if you're coming up with new ideas that don't fit the paradigm of those, quote, prophets that have gone before, you're not going to get any funding. And that's, I'm glad to see that somebody stood up and said enough, so tell me more.
Well, just to elaborate on what you just said, in science, life, there's a saying, follow the money. And it turns out that's true in science as well. And the reason why we got this skew in the first place is because back in the 80s, when the NASA first proposed the Hubble Space Telescope, they were turned down flat by Congress, saying it didn't have enough public relevance for the times.
Oh, my goodness.
Given its expense. So they went back to the drawing board and came back to Congress with a new proposal that said, in effect, if you fund the space telescope, we assure you that within a decade or so of its launch, it will discover proof of the Big Bang, proof of black holes, proof of dark matter, proof of dark energy, and these things are of interest to the public, so you ought to fund it. And so Congress did, but you see the problem there. those were things that should have been explored, not in order to get the funding, NASA essentially told Congress, we're going to prove these things are true, the reality was that the observational evidence discovered by these magnificent telescopes they put in orbit has gone in a different direction. And there they were, caught in the middle. The arguments they made, they didn't want to see undermined, and they didn't want to back down, so they were trapped into support for the theories they were trying to prove, and the evidence has gone the other way. So this, it began with 37 cosmologists signing the statement that was published, and as soon as the word got out, they were joined by hundreds more, and today online, the statement has over 500 signatures. With many of them with the institutions associated, to the effect that they think it's time for a change. And that ultimately led to this meeting next week in Port Angeles, Washington, out on the Olympic Peninsula, where 50 of the world's cosmologists are getting together to go over the major arguments in 8 different areas that say the Big Bang has reached the end of its line, and to lay out the criteria for what a successful cosmology should look like.
Well, that's really exciting stuff. Now, you call this the second Crisis in Cosmology conference.
Yes.
I guess you had one a year ago.
The statement came out in 2004, and the first Crisis in Cosmology conference was in Portugal in 2005.
Uh-huh.
And it was still fairly early for this movement, and the two pillars hadn't fallen yet. So there was a lot of evidence brought forward, but the conclusion of the conference was, yes, the Big Bang is in big trouble, but we haven't got all the answers yet, and there's no clear consensus as to what should follow it. But since then, the two pillars of the Big Bang have fallen. There is a clear path now showing that the Big Bang cannot be part of a correct cosmology. And instead of saying, vote for your favorite new cosmology, we're working on just on the principles that a good cosmology must obey, such as you don't want a scientific theory to be based on miracles. This isn't an argument that there are no miracles, just that in science, you don't start a theory or anywhere in the course of a theory, you don't say, and then a miracle happened, because that's just basically saying you don't know how to get to that step. And if you argued that such a theory was complete, then that would end inquiry or exploration, because there would be no hope of ever understanding it, or much less predicting, using the theory to predict something. So, if in science, given a choice between two paths, one of which is based on a miracle and the other which isn't, science must always choose the one that isn't, so that we can stay on the path of understanding and predictability.
Well, that's good. You're not going to start a conference with the words, "In the beginning was the Word." You know, you have a quote on one of your slide presentations on your website. It's from Churchill. It says, "Man will occasionally stumble over the truth, but most of the time he will pick himself up and continue."
Yes.
Boy,
very insightful, that fella.
We sure see that. Oh, my gosh. Even in the renewable energy business, especially politicians, but politicians are becoming a non-issue in our industry. It's now a matter of private investors and consumers, because fuel prices are so high, people are really motivated now to do something about it, and so money is now beginning to move. But in the problems with the Big Bang, and I was raised on it and never really believed in it, but you couldn't really find anything written out there. You couldn't find any major instruments that were measuring forces that didn't agree with it. Hubble was an amazing telescope that was launched with the primary mission of aging the universe, which it did, you know, as a matter of fact. And then the darn thing kept on working. So it's returned, you know, images that millions of people have enjoyed. Motion pictures have used the stock images from the Hubble, and literally turned on, you know, every 10-year-old in the world to the wonder of space. Because the best we could do before we started being capable of tuning out the interference from our atmosphere, which now we can do, so that the best telescopes now are terrestrial-based. But up until that time, Hubble was, you know, a dream come true. These deep space shots were just phenomenal. They opened up the imagination to real images that just changed everything. But that being the case, a lot of people are gathering this data and beginning to philosophically, if not scientifically, move through the data and say, gee, if this is true, and then, you know, they're syllogistically making a premise for a conclusion that takes us in a logical, albeit different direction than cosmology has been taking us. So you sent out your call for papers. Who answered the call?
Quite a number of the world's cosmologists who have, in the course of their careers, come upon evidence that is quite inconsistent with the Big Bang theory. Probably cosmologists are not household names to most of your listeners, but many of them might have heard of Halton Arp, who has written several books. One of the most recent that's fairly popular was called Seeing Red, which is a play on the redshift of galaxies and the problems with it. Eric Lerner is the author of a well-known book called The Big Bang Never Happened. He is a student of Hans Alfvén, who is the originator of one of the alternative cosmologies called plasma cosmology. There are four major cosmologies that are competitors of the Big Bang. the quasi-steady-state cosmology championed by the late Fred Hoyle, by Burbidge and Narlikar, and some other cosmologists. That one, too, has an expanding universe, so it needs to be rethought in the light of the new evidence. Then there's plasma cosmology, which is indifferent to whether the universe is expanding or not, and just thinks of everything as being basically condensates of massive clouds of plasma. There is variable mass cosmology, which was championed by ARP, and he is focusing on the objects called quasars and arguing that instead of the conventional Big Bang view of them, they're actually ejections from galaxies that are destined to become locations for new star birth and gradually grow into new galaxies. And he is put out some pretty compelling evidence that quasars are indeed ejected from galaxies, even though they have very different redshifts from the galaxies that they're associated with. And then last in the majors is the Meta Model, which is the one favored by Meta Research, the outfit I work for. And it's the only cosmology that, in a way, it's not really a cosmology in the same sense as the others, which is a description of the universe we observe. Rather, it's a theoretical framework that comes from the idea of let's start from scratch, assume nothing exists, and then introduce one unit of substance into a completely non-existent universe and describe its properties. And amazingly, it's pretty hard to do that because you can't tell if it's moving or not if there's nothing else to compare to. You can't tell if it's spinning. You can't tell much of anything about it.
Yeah, there's no perspective at all. But that's really not that hard to imagine because, you know, nearly all the, I'm going to call them religions, but nearly all the historical data that's been recorded in ancient documents talks about a void being present and then all of a sudden this awakening, this awareness, this I am moment happened. And whatever it was that appeared was conscious, sentient, and realized, hey, I'm alone and there's no perspective and I can't tell if I'm moving and I need to do something about this. So whether it was wave and then collapsed into particle or was in another dimension and came into this one or came through a wormhole, somehow that introduction happened, and so carry us forward from here.
Okay, well, actually, the Meta Model goes in a slightly different direction. It builds a universe one bit of substance at a time, introducing new properties that come into existence as you introduce each new element of substance. So if there are two units of substance, they can't tell how far apart they are, or if they came into contact and then were apart again and came into contact again, they couldn't tell how long an interval that was because there is absolutely nothing against
no
which to measure change. No frame of reference for measuring change or distance. So it takes a while before you get the concepts of space and time, and then ultimately a scale. But the picture that comes out of this kind of reasoning, before I give the bottom line, the reasoning is based on what's called the principles of physics, which are the things that must logically be true if there are no miracles at the beginning, and things such as you can't create something from nothing. You can create things from things that are invisible to us. That's just a limit of our instruments. But you can't create something from literally nothing. And
unless
the
you're an engineer. We do that all the time.
Yes. Yeah, we always have to go over definitions and terms. the word create we use very loosely in language, and we just mean that we're inspired to make something, make a new form that wasn't there before. All forms are finite; they're limited in
right
in size and in duration relative to other forms. So they all start at some point, but they're all assembled from things that already existed. And when they end their lives, either by decomposing or exploding, all the parts still exist. They just dispersed.
Yeah, they just change form. Right.
All forms are temporary, but substance itself is never either created from nothing, nor can it go back into nothingness.
Right.
And that's one of the principles. And another one is every effect must have a cause in front of it. An effect without a cause would be a miracle. The finite cannot become infinite, and so on. Things that are logically necessary if miracles don't happen. So with those premises and building the universe step by step, this framework tells us that the ultimate picture has a kind of new concept of time as a measure of change and of space as a measure of separation and of scale such that space is infinite, time is eternal, and scale is unlimited. So that means there is no such thing as the smallest possible particle or a largest possible structure. We're existing here on this scale, here and now, but we might, our whole universe might be just a small dust particle in a much larger scale mega universe.
On a piece of popcorn in a movie theater somewhere.
Exactly. And conversely, on the small scale, there might be intelligent beings way down there living their entire existence and maybe even the entire existence of their universe in what to us is just the click of fingers or even just a nanosecond.
Wow.
So the relativity of everything.
Tom, we have a caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please.
Hello, Dr. Agnew. This is Mark from Nashport, Ohio.
Hi, Mark. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Dr. Van Flandern, I have two quick questions. Is there any evidence of an ancient civilization on Mars and the Moon? And two, is there any possibility that some of these destroyed planets were the result of an ancient war? And I'll take the answer offline.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay. Well, Brooks, the Mars anomalies is another whole subject. Perhaps it would be.
That's okay. We're driven by our callers. So let's take it on. Was there an ancient civilization on Mars, and how about ancient wars?
Well, let's do the second question first, because that ties in with what we've already been talking about, and then we'll drift off into new territory.
Okay.
The cause of the explosions. The direct evidence from traceback of orbits suggests that the explosions happened from the center outward and not from the surface inward. So we think that collisions and surface events are ruled out as the cause. More than that, I mentioned six possible explosions of major planets and a number of explosions of moons. They are spaced out in time over millions, even hundreds of millions, billions of years, which doesn't sound like the workings of a civilization. If somebody were coming in and blowing up planets for mining purposes or something or other, then you'd see clusters of such explosions, but we don't, in fact, see that in the data. So the answer is I think that the explosions are through natural processes, and in fact, what we see as so-called classical novas, which we take to be explosions of stars, are in reality explosions of visible objects orbiting other stars, and they were previously thought to be white dwarfs or neutron stars, but We now know that planets are a good possibility, too, and that they may be explosions of planets around other stars. I think that covers the second question. And then how shall we introduce the interesting subject of Mars anomalies?
we had some interesting photographs show up from our first, shall we call them, close past photography of Mars. One of them was a face and became extrapolated into a city and some complexes. And then we took closer looks, and the closer looks, maybe they supported it, maybe they didn't. I've heard a couple of speculations, but there's no doubt when you start looking at the odds of mutually exclusive events that it would take to structure the things that have been photographed on Mars, then it begins to open possibilities. So let's go in that direction.
Okay. Just to dispose of the second part of that first question about the moon, the discussion of possible artifacts on the moon is to my mind and to that of most of the professional researchers not at all compelling or persuasive. There is a Russian astronomer who did wrote a computer program to scan all of the high resolution images that have been taken of the moon from one of the lunar orbiting spacecraft, Clementine, and look for regular shapes that don't normally occur in nature, squares and triangles and that sort of thing. And he came up with several dozen candidates of things that we ought to go back and take a closer look at someday when we're exploring the lunar surface. But none of them is in any way compelling or jumps out at you the way hundreds of things that we've seen on Mars do. So when comparing our moon to Mars, I'd say there's no comparison. Our moon yet
right.
doesn't have any evidence for artifacts that crosses the threshold for a skeptic, whereas Mars does, even though a lot of skeptics aren't prepared to go there.
Well, still, the higher, the more resolution we throw into the photography of these two bodies, our moon and Mars, we don't see, in fact, we see the theories and the guesses and the superstitions about the moon not being supported by the data. I mean, the more clear we make the pictures, the more natural the surface of the moon looks.
Mm-hmm.
The exact opposite is occurring on Mars. Why?
Yes. That is true. Let's set the table because it's going to turn out to be an interesting meal, I think. This ties back to the exploded planet hypothesis. We mentioned the missing planet in the middle of the asteroid belt. Well, the main asteroid belt actually has an outer part and an inner part. The outer part apparently consisted of what are called carbonaceous type asteroids and are the result of the explosion of a body that we've given the name Planet K, that was given it by Michael Ovenden, a Canadian dynamical astronomer with a tip of the hat to modern, shall we say, legends and modern tales of that have come down to us in our times. He named it Planet K after Krypton, Superman's home planet, because
gotcha.
It exploded. The name aside and the implications aside, there's also an inner part to the main asteroid belt that consists of primarily silicaceous asteroids, things that are more glassy or sandy, sand-like. That goes right up to and past the orbit of Mars. And there are indications that there was another planet at the orbit of Mars, which has been given the name Planet V. V for Roman numeral 5, as X, Planet X was given to me for Roman numeral 10. But now the numbering of planets is completely different than it used to be, so these Roman numerals haven't worked out. But anyway, historically it was called Planet V. Planet V is the hypothetical planet that originally occupied the orbit Mars is now in. And Mars and another body, now named Bellona, were moons of Planet V and orbited that planet for billions of years until it exploded 65 million years ago. That is, Planet V exploded 65 million years ago.
I see.
Then its other moon, Bellona, exploded 3 million years ago, 3.2 to be exact, leaving Mars alone in that orbit today. Now, here's what's interesting about that theory. What it means is that Mars is not an original planet, but a moon of an original planet, which fits nicely into other thinking about the solar system, because we think the other small planets also originated as moons and not as planets. My late colleague Robert Harrington and I published a paper in the 70s showing the evidence that Mercury is an escaped moon of Venus.
Sure. That's very well accepted now that somehow Venus spit off its moon Mercury, which broke away from the orbit around Venus and now has assumed its own orbit around the Sun. Occur about this same time? I mean, do we have some massive gravitational event that's yanking planets out of their orbits, moons away from planets, and shattering others?
That event occurred way back at the beginning of the solar system, within the first half billion years. And it occurred naturally from tidal forces. Our own moon is getting further and further away from the Earth today, but only by a couple of inches a year. And as it does, it's robbing Earth of its spin. That's where the angular momentum or energy is coming from. But the moon is not massive enough to escape from the Earth. Mercury was a little bit bigger than our moon, and it was massive enough to escape from Venus, and apparently did so very early on, just from the same forces that are operating on our moon today, which is tidal friction. And then Pluto, we think, is an escaped moon of Neptune. So all of these small bodies, we think, were former moons, and Mars would be among them. So the importance of that is if Mars was a moon rather than the home world, then the kinds of anomalies we're seeing start to make a little more sense. First, the evidence for this otherwise surprising, startling idea that Mars was a moon of a planet that exploded. If you think about this in your imagination, Mars as a major moon would do just as our moon does to the Earth and all the major moons in the solar system do to their parent planets, namely keeps the same face toward the parent planet. That's inevitable because of these tidal forces that I mentioned. So if Mars keeps the same face toward its parent planet and the parent planet explodes, what happens to Mars? It gets blasted all over on one side and hardly touched at all on the other side.
Exactly.
Well, that was the most of a surprising discovery about Mars that the space program turned up. Mars is like two hemispheres glued together. One side is saturated with craters, sometimes huge craters, huge numbers of large craters, one hemisphere's worth, and then the other hemisphere is flat and smooth and relatively crater-free. And the the cratered hemisphere has a crust that's up to 20 kilometers thick in the middle, tapering off toward the edges, and the smooth hemisphere is a flat 1 kilometer thick all over. These are the descriptions I'm giving you are non-controversial descriptions of Mars itself that we've come to know in the space age, but they are also descriptions of exactly what would happen to the moon of a planet that blew up.
Sure.
Other lines of evidence, Mars, we know the present pole of Mars wasn't the original pole. The original pole suddenly tipped over by nearly 90 degrees in a very rapid movement. Well, if you put a lot of weight on one side of Mars, the spin is going to be unstable, like putting a weight on a spinning top. It becomes unstable, and it'll tip over until the spin axis goes through the weight. So that agrees, too. And then Mars lost most of the original thick atmosphere it had, and it has there are samples of the atmosphere from the lander show that it has isotopes of xenon that can only come from a major explosion, and on. There's a list of about 20 lines of evidence, and we have a pretty cool video at our website called Violent History of Mars. And you can again see that at go to your website and link to ours, or go directly to metaresearch.org. In the left column, you'll see a link to Violent History of Mars video, and it's a nicely done video showing the history of what I've just told you about with the two moons, Mars and Bellona, orbiting Planet V. Planet V explodes, what it does to the two moons, then leaving one in orbit around the other, why Bellona explodes later and leaving Mars in the condition it is today, and all of the major geological features of Mars, the evidence for a massive one-time flood, the volcanism at the equator and so on, are all explained very nicely by this scenario. So we've got this new kind of history of Mars and a view of Mars that is very different than the traditional one in all the astronomy books. But it's well supported by the evidence. And in fact, we saw just recently there were a series of articles that were touted by NASA and published in Nature magazine, trying to explain the anomalies, the hemispheric dichotomy, as it's called on Mars, using traditional theories. In traditional thinking, see, it's a big puzzle why Mars's two hemispheres are so different. In traditional thinking, the cratered hemisphere is normal, and something must have removed all the craters from the northern hemisphere.
Exactly.
So that's the abnormal one. Yeah, in reality, we see that the smooth hemisphere actually does have a lot of subsurface craters that were simply buried by sand and windstorms over millions of years, but they are there, and that the cratered hemisphere has to be relatively young because those craters have not been buried by winds and sand, and therefore have to be the result of a fairly recent cataclysmic event. But that's the...
Now we're not talking about 65 million years ago that Mars was pelted by its exploding planet, or are we?
Yes, the major explosion was 65 million years ago, and then the secondary one was 3.2 million years ago.
Okay.
And that's the one that produced this massive one-time flood on Mars, because Bellona was a very watery planet like the Earth or Europa around Jupiter.
So the thing that really excited the general public was that these photos began coming back, first from Voyager and then from subsequent missions that took closer and closer looks at this. There was a face on Mars, and some people have said, it's just a natural formation. But as we began taking better, closer and closer looks at it, we started seeing other things besides just the face. And we actually saw an arrangement of structures that did not seem natural. And then what would, you know, normally be considered from a far distance, maybe just cracks in the soil, but upon closer examination, these were not cracks at all. These were actually structures, and they jump ravines, and they go against the grain of the natural formation of the land, and it really, really started getting the imagination going.
That's a very good summary. There are a couple of hundred pictures of Mars out of the hundreds of thousands that have been taken at high resolution that are eye-popping, in the sense that if you looked at it and weren't told that it was a NASA photograph of Mars, you would swear it had to be taken on Earth.
Wow.
Some of the simplest examples are just closed triangles, which don't normally occur in nature, and there are so many of them on Mars and nowhere else in the solar system, except, of course, on Earth, where humans are responsible for a lot of closed triangles. But stepping up from that, there are long tracks through the desert that look like they have machinery imprints in them, and they seem to navigate in that they never cut through craters. They always graze by the edge of craters as
wow.
if they had some steering. And these are some of the simpler anomalies. An interesting one that doesn't directly relate to artifacts, but Arthur C. Clarke's favorite is a photograph showing an area that's in the region that probably is fed occasionally by water from the polar regions that melts, or by hot springs under the surface, where you would swear what you were looking at is the growth of a large tree, because it seems to have branch-like structure and a central. It looks like a tree seen from above, so it seems to have like a center area over the trunk, branching out from there at several levels, and it's casting shadows on the ground. And some later pictures indicated that some of these objects that look vegetative do change with the seasons and do have a predominantly green appearance to them.
Wow.
So it would be very tempting to call them trees or vegetation. Arthur C. Clarke, the late well-known science fiction writer, just said that he thinks we've been short-sighted about the probability of natural life having evolved on Mars, too, and that he's 95% sure that these things are some kind of overlooked life forms. On our neighboring planet. This also ties in with all the evidence that has piled up of late for bacterial life on Mars too, which is another whole story in its own right, but suffice it to say, the evidence is compelling and has been confirmed recently by the European Space Agency in several aspects that there are certain chemicals in the atmosphere of Mars, such as methane, formaldehyde, so on, that have short half-lives, require a relatively recent source. The only known sources are volcanism and biology, and there's no active volcanism on Mars today.
On the surface of Mars that we can see.
On the surface
see.
Of Mars.
Let's go ahead and take advantage of this. Let's go ahead and take a break, and when we come back, we're going to delve into this with both arms. Let's get all the way, elbows deep in it. Our phone number is 888-228-4494, toll-free U.S. Give us a call. We'll be back after these messages with more X Squared Radio.
friends down at NRG Resources have introduced a new engine oil technology. TVT 24/7 is the future of lubrication. This is the industry's first environmentally friendly oil additive that not only increases fuel mileage, it reduces engine, gearbox, and transaxle wear to nothing. The other brands fail anti-friction testing in less than 10 minutes under standard testing conditions. TVT 24/7 went more than 24 hours in the test and still did not fail. Get tomorrow's technology today by visiting the online store at X Squared Radio and pick up TVT 24/7 Engine Oil Energizer. There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back, Earth Explorers. Third and final hour of X Squared Radio, August 31st, 2008, coming to you live from Eastern Washington State, up against the Canadian border. My guest tonight is Tom Van Flandern, and besides being one of the most widely published astronomers in the world. By the way, if you haven't read a book on astronomy or cosmology, you need to pick up this book. It's called Dark Matter, Missing Planets and New Comets, subtitled Paradoxes Resolved,
Origins Illuminated. Good book. And it's well written, and when you finish it, not only are you going to have a sense of accomplishment, but you're going to be able to hold your own at just about any dinner table conversation about the origin of the universe. And I know that's important to you because you're listening to this program. This hour, we traditionally go beyond the imagination of most listeners. And we're going to leave the phone lines open. We have about 49 minutes. The phone line's toll-free, 888-228-4494 in the United States, 877-489-6350 in Canada. Those of you that have free long distance on the weekends because you have cell phones, you can reach us at 530-776-5154. That's the Channel 2 call-in number because we're on BBS Radio Late Night Live. Skype, you can reach us at BBS Radio, and Pal Talk, you can reach us at BBSRadio_com. And we are also coming to you live via the Steel Eye Media Network, our friend Kevin Smith, KevinSmithRadio.com, during the weeknights if you want to catch that program. We have been discussing the artificiality of surface anomalies on Mars as compared to a very natural and well-examined surface of our moon. And some of these structures are really going to blow your mind. I want you to write this website down. It'll take you several visits to get through all the information. It's metaresearch.org. Go there, click on all the links, because there's something there for everyone. Lots of graphics, lots of excellent papers. You can go as deep as you want to go. And my guest is Tom Van Flandern, and we're going to resume our discussion on Mars. Tom, I was, of course, looking on your website, and I see the best photographs I have ever seen on the phenomenon known as glass tubes on Mars. I can see the photos, but fill me in on the lecture. What are these things?
We would really love to know what they are, and we will. There will always be doubt until we get some ground truth and take a close-up look and a sample. But we've learned a lot about them from space. Wherever the ground is fissured, perhaps I shouldn't say wherever, but commonly in fissures. In the ground, we see in the cracks objects that have been given the description glassy tubes because that's what they look like. They are typically 50 to 100 meters in diameter, which is fairly good size. Mm-hmm. And they are wrapped by white bands around and around, and the in-between material seems to be transparent. Translucent. In cases where the sunlight glints off the glassy tubes, it doesn't scatter sunlight the way natural surfaces do. It sends back a sharp image of the sun the way water or a shiny surface would, something metallic or glassy. Now, that's just the surface description of what these tubes look like. As I say, usually we see them where the ground is either fissured or where the topsoil has been worn away. Sometimes we see the top of a glassy tube come up through the surface. But in many places we see that they network. They have junctions. They will go down parallel paths or connect to one another, or they're perpendicular junctions. There are places where there are even tubes coming in from many different directions that seem to collect together and form a sort of terminal of tubes. When we look at the details of some of the tubes, we see cases where in some of the going competing theories for what these might be are they might be sand dunes or lava tubes. Well, there are certain cases where we can rule out those competing theories. For example, we can see at least one case where one tube crosses over another perpendicularly, and you can see the white bands going in one direction on the top tube and in a perpendicular direction on the bottom tube, making for a checkerboard pattern. And
right.
Of course, you can't have sand dunes perpendicular to each other at the same place at the same time. The same problem exists with lava tubes. They do cast shadows, so they do have vertical relief. And it's very interesting that in places where the tubes are broken, for example, if a large boulder has rolled into a tube and broken it, you'll see part of the intact tube looking just as I described, and then you'll see the boulder, and then beyond that point, you see, just at the break point, you see the white bands are spindly, where they've clearly been broken off and very pointed and jagged looking. And then beyond that, you see the collapsed tube lying flat on the ground with twice as many white streaks per unit distance as in the uncollapsed part. And that's because the white bands wrap all the way around. So that when you collapse a tube, you're seeing both the top part of the white band and the bottom part lying side by side. So you see twice as many per unit distance. So the totality of all this evidence is that they're mysterious, they're very artificial looking in appearance. We don't know what they might have been functionally, but we can add one more interesting fact to the mix. When we step back and look at the larger picture, where are these glassy tubes as far as we can tell? The answer is they seem to connect interesting places on the surface of the planet. For example, in the Cydonia region, where the face on Mars is, and many other interesting anomalies, as you've already alluded to, and we can come back to and talk about the evidence for artificiality there. There's a feature in Cydonia called the fort. There's not enough detail there to say that it looks like a fort, but it does look like in the resolution we could see it. It looks sort of like some kind of a structure with a triangular interior. And right out of the back of it is coming a glassy tube. Right out of the back center wall is a glassy tube. And the tube comes out a short distance and then drops down below the surface of the sand, and we don't see it anymore. Well, that was the case until recently when we got spacecraft that had ground-penetrating radar and also infrared, which could sense heat instead of light. And the infrared pictures were especially interesting because when you look at the surface features in infrared, they take on a very different appearance because anything that's sunlit is hot and very bright in an infrared picture, and anything that's in shadow is very cold, and the surface that's scattering the heat is usually much colder than the rocks are, and so on. So it gives you a very different picture, but you can see also the heat patterns a little bit below the surface because heat does radiate up through the surface of the ground. And the glassy tube seems to go just below the surface and continue, and you can see a clear signature of it in the infrared pictures. And the glassy tube goes out a certain distance and then veers off to the southeast and goes right to the center of the next mesa about 20 kilometers away and goes into that mesa and connects to it, and then another branch of the tube goes up to the face mesa and connects into the center of the west wall of the face mesa. So these things aren't going at random. They're connecting interesting surface features. And that all by itself is quite an amazing fact, and it begs the mind to think of one's hard pressed to think of ways that nature could do this, so it begs the mind to think of what would possibly be the purpose of this for some hypothetical builders who came along. Well, for that and for a lot of the other anomalies we'll get to in just a moment as we dig in with both arms, as you said, keep in mind the table we set for this, that Mars is a former moon and not an original planet, and that the home world was probably elsewhere, maybe the world Bellona. So the impact of that is that we're not expecting, even if these are artificial, we're not expecting to see the remains of an ancient civilization with cities and highways and towers and that sort of thing.
Rather, an effective mining operation.
Yes, that sort of thing. It's interesting to project what we think our moon will look like in 1,000 or 2,000 years when travel from here to our moon is routine. And there will be mining operations, there will be communications, there will be science, there will be tourism, every kind of industry you can imagine that has any advantage in being on the moon will be there. And when you take off for a weekend visit to the moon, first thing you do is hop in an orbiting space station to get an overview of the ground. And so what are the folks on the ground going to do to draw your attention and why you should land there and visit them? They're going to build attractions on the surface, something to catch your eye and catch your view. And also the different places on the surface are going to link themselves by means of transportation or perhaps energy connections or perhaps sewage, who knows. But there probably will be, since there's no atmosphere, there will probably be underground tubes of some sort on our own moon. So what we project, when we think hard about it, for what our civilization will probably do on our moon in 1,000 years from now, that's the kind of thing that we're seeing on Mars. And as we dig in some more, we'll see even more examples. And that's the background to keep in mind maybe what's really going on here that is the only thing that seems to make any sense with some of these anomalies.
Well, the interesting thing when you look at these structures, and they're not isolated. They're not one here, and then you have to go, you know, a couple thousand miles around the planet, and you find a couple more. They're connected like a network, And the interesting question that keeps coming to my email is, okay, we're sending rovers up. We have, you know, high-resolution cameras going around Mars. Why aren't we landing ground probes close to these things so we can drive up to the sucker and take a picture from ground level? Let's see if this thing extends 100 meters above the eroded soil and has somehow weathered whatever horrible conditions there are at the surface of Mars, 1,000th the density of our atmosphere, and yet terrible dust storms that we can see from here. If it's weathered that, it's got to be pretty tough. I'd love to get a picture from the ground, 100 feet away from it.
Yes, we all would. And one of the frustrations about studying Mars anomalies, even the much more interesting ones that we haven't come to yet, is that in 50 years, every school child will know what's going on Mars, but we're left to stumble around here with just a few pieces of the puzzle trying to guess what the end picture is going to look like.
No, I'm coming back. I'm not going to miss that. You know, there's a civilian contest out there right now, a $20 million prize. for this first civilian that successfully lands a rover on Mars and gets it to drive a certain distance.
Hmm.
$20 million prize. Now, it can't be that hard. I mean, it's been done. So, you know, a bunch of college kids from JPL did it. Yeah, it bounced a couple times, but it unloaded. It drives around. It's lasted a year and a half, 2 years longer than they thought it would. I talked to Jim Bell at Caltech, and they're all just flabbergasted that they still have funding to drive the things around, Spirit and Opportunity. They're still operational.
Yep. Yes, they are. And, it would be great, so great if we did have that capability and could drive right up to some of these anomalies and see what they are, see what a glassy tube is, see what the face mesa is.
I'd be glued to my television set.
We all would. One thing is the existing probes have been targeted to areas where the landing looks sort of featureless for safety reasons, because they're afraid if the terrain is too rough or too unpredictable, the spacecraft will not survive.
Oh, sure.
But
thing's got the world's biggest airbag on it. It could survive. Let's land on Main Street. Let's take a picture.
There's a more sinister reason going on here, that the Jet Propulsion Laboratory is worried about funding. All through the 60s, they had funding for all of the spacecraft we sent flying past the moon, orbiting the moon, crash landing on the moon. And then when the first manned mission came, they were cut out of the picture, and all the missions went back to NASA. So JPL put out the word that manned missions are too expensive and too dangerous, and succeeded in getting the Apollo missions killed. But it took them a long time to recover, and finally they got approved for a number of missions to Mars, one or two launches every couple of years when Mars is in the right position, up through the year 2016. And each of these missions has been assigned a goal. And the goal of the early ones is to just look around and see if there's any mineralogy that might have been affected by water. And the Spirit and Opportunity carried no instrument at all to detect water, even though it apparently was leaving muddy tracks and liquid filling in the tracks behind it. But there was a future mission, namely the Phoenix mission that just landed, that would do the test for water. So they didn't want to undercut the justification for the future mission, so they said nothing about water.
Oh, that's good.
And the same thing is true about the finding of living organisms. The next several missions are to determine if life could ever existed on Mars in the form of organisms, fossil organisms. And if we announce that discovery now, the justification for the next several missions is gone. So it's back to the drawing board. So they're actually slowing progress by crippling these spacecraft, so we don't discover too much too fast, because jobs and careers and money is at stake.
Right. So instead of putting the ground probing radar on Spirit and Opportunity, or having it work in concert with Marsis going around in orbit, they put an alpha particle spectrometer on there and look at it that way, and then wait for Phoenix. And so each one don't they realize, though, that with these great discoveries, that their funding wouldn't be coming from the government? It would be coming from the public. The public would be pouring billions of dollars into JPL, going, we want Chapter 2 of this reality program.
Well, the fear is that while there would be a lot more funding for the space program, most of it would be going into other pockets, over at the manned NASA centers, for example, because when you're investigating something like a possible artifact, such as the face on Mars might be, or the Cydonia region, you can't program a robot with all the contingencies of what you're going to do if you roll up to a window or a door and if you have it, the right tool even to try and open it, what are you going to program it to do when it goes inside, given the almost unlimited number of possibilities of what's on the other side?
Especially when it takes 30 minutes to make a data exchange between the two.
That's right. So it looks...
All that being said, you're talking about putting humans on the surface of a planet that's sterile for a reason. It's being bombarded by cosmic radiation, which we, you know, take for granted that our planet blocks. And you're putting them in a place where you couldn't possibly send a rescue mission if something went wrong. And fortunately, human life still means so much to us that we won't risk, I was going to say, a single person's life doing so, although we routinely strap bodies to hydrogen peroxide rockets and launch them into orbit when we know we have better technology than that. So maybe maybe that statement doesn't hold too much water either.
I know that there would be a lot of volunteers, even if it were a one-way mission to Mars. There is so much to be discovered, and who wouldn't? There are a lot of people who would leap at the chance to be that historic first guy to go there and see with human eyes what's really there. But the reality is that we have jobs and money and careers at stake, and there's a certain schedule that will be adhered to, and the powers that be want to keep everything the way it is now, with the money flowing the way it is now. And that's frustrating for those of us who would like to rush forward, but probably comforting for people who think the future is already coming at us much too fast.
Well, yeah, and of course, it adds to the sinisterness, if that's such a word, to realize that 99% of the funding is getting to JPL after it goes through military hands.
I'm not following you there. The JPL is exclusive with NASA, so all its funding comes from NASA, and all of NASA's funding comes from Congress, and by law, NASA can't do classified projects. All of its products are open to the world.
And so we're saying that the space shuttle has not taken up super secret satellites and put them into orbit.
Well, the military has its own super-secret spacecraft that it launches and it controls.
I understand. Okay.
I'm not saying there aren't secrets. So I'm just saying NASA isn't supposed to participate in them. I suppose they could, if the circumstances demanded it, there could be an arrangement whereby the astronauts could take a secret package up and for the military, but... As a general rule, that doesn't happen. The military launches its own, and the astronauts don't have clearance to know what's in secret military projects.
Well, it's interesting. I'm just hanging on with fingernails, you know, waiting for the next successful landing on Mars, and hopefully it'll be in the neighborhood of one of these things that's going on. And, you know, there's such public clamor for it. I would think that, you know, they would at least respond to it, because, you know, those kids that go to JPL, I co-opt up there, you know, when I grew up in Pasadena, and it's a busy place. There's a lot going on. You can do any kind of task that you can think of, and of course in those days JPL was locked into the Apollo program when I went in the Air Force, but you know, there are parents that send those children to JPL to co-op and later get jobs there. If you look at any of JPL's videos on their websites, none of these people are older than 28 or 27. They don't even wear glasses. They're so young. And they make their careers there, or at least they lay the groundwork for their educational careers at Caltech or other educational institutions. by doing a co-op or doing a couple of years at JPL. The salaries are not stellar because they run on grant money. They run on, you know, from one government program to the next. However, you're talking about the America's and sometimes other countries' best and brightest working at the most amazing science fair, 24-hour-a-day science fair there in Pasadena. Some of them are thinking, you know, let's leapfrog this thing. Let's go take a photograph or a sample that will blow the minds of everyone on this planet.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true enough. And we really should talk a bit more about some of those anomalies you've alluded to a couple of times now that represent some of the samples that will blow people's minds on this planet. For example, the famous face on Mars at Cydonia. It's just one of many anomalies that have the general character of the kind of pictographs that exist on the plains of Nazca and in Peru that can only be seen from above, but they look very much like terrestrial things. And at the Cydonia area in particular, they're organized, which is part of the evidence that they aren't products of nature. So you see a lot of pictographs in a 20-kilometer square area that look like insects in one area and amphibious things in another area and mammals in another area and aviary or bird-like things in another area and mammalian-like things in another area.
That's amazing. Tom, we have a caller. Let's go ahead and take the caller first, and then we'll jump into those. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from.
Yeah, it's Will from Virginia Beach.
Hi, Will. Welcome to the program.
Hello. I like the fact that they actually at least have an astronomer on the show, and I've been looking at the stars a lot lately because there is this thing that actually, two things I was going to bring up. There's, it's like a star. It looks like a star. It's twinkling, but it's twinkling red and blue, nanosecond by nanosecond, and it's always
white
in the background.
I've seen that too.
And I know it's not a star.
Is this in the west?
I don't know if you've ever heard of that.
It's in the eastern sky, right?
Yes, and I have been to Maine, and I saw one also in Maine that actually had an orange light glowing every time, and I even talked to somebody, and a security guard looked up at it and said, yeah, we've seen that many times, and I don't really know what it is. And I was like, yeah, that's one thing that just does not happen with stars. They usually twinkle just white, you know? And I've also seen pictures that the Hubble took of another thing that's very interesting, the actual double helix nebula. I don't know if you've heard of that before.
Yeah, sure, it's a well-known nebula.
But have you heard? Have you seen these stars blinking over and over? Because George Green also, and I don't know if you even heard of him, or but he's talked about these things possibly being motherships of aliens just are looking down at us.
Well, so far, I've done a lot of looking at the sky myself and other astronomers. Have two with telescopes, and we have yet to see anything through a telescope that looks like a mothership, but that could just be because they avoid us or for whatever reason. So I don't discount reports of such things. I just can tell you that in the many years I've been watching the sky, I have yet to see something I could not definitely identify.
Well, Tom, why do they flicker in colors? Because I've seen it too. I mean, red, blue, orange, and sometimes even green. Why do they flicker in colors?
Well, stars flicker in color because the light is coming through our atmosphere, and the more turbulent the atmosphere is, the more the star will twinkle or flicker. Planets, on the other hand, usually have a large enough disk that their light is pretty steady and exempt from most twinkling. At first I thought your caller might be looking at bright objects that just appeared over in the western sky, which is the planet Venus. It's just come back into the evening sky and is visible just after sunset. But apparently, no, he's talking about something else. And without a lot more information, I couldn't hazard a guess as to what it is he's seeing.
Hey, Will, let me throw this in here, Will. I was up at LIGO, which is the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, a couple of weeks ago, and I was talking to Dr. Rob, who runs the facility there. And they have recently written, let's call it a noise reduction program for ground-based telescopes. It works much the same as active noise reduction does on headphones, except this works for telescopes. And it tunes out the interference from Earth's atmosphere for ground-based telescopes. And the woman that wrote the program has been cursed by the more romantic of the community for taking the twinkle out of the stars, because now the stars are just crystal clear through her using her feedback program.
Yes, that's cute.
Well, my uncle does have a telescope. I haven't actually looked through it yet. I do want to actually scope on that one that's just blinking red and blue all the time, because I see it every single night, and I've even seen it where it actually, like, it doesn't move left and right, or it moves away. In other words, the actual star becomes smaller. I've seen that with my own eyes. And I even had a witness with me that actually saw it and said, that's weird, because the thing actually just went from very bright and twinkling the red and blue, and then it went very, very small, as if it just went further out, you know? And that doesn't happen with stars.
Well, one thing that would be interesting to do is watch it over a period of time and see if it keeps its place in the sky relative to the ground, or it keeps its place in the sky relative to the moon and stars, because the Earth is rotating, and so the sky rotates 15 degrees every hour, and way you'll know if it's in space or something in the Earth's atmosphere.
Well, I would love to actually just have a telescope and then peer in on it just to see if I can see those lights blinking a little more in depth, and so I'm thinking about trying to do that very soon, but I wish it could, because I know it's different parts of the continent that you can't really see certain things because you're in a different geographical location. So, but you're saying, Brooks, that you actually have seen this one that actually is up there every night. And there's even another one. I'm talking about there's two.
I've seen it and been fascinated by it. I could tell you, if you're going to buy a telescope, you really want to gather a bunch of light for not very much money. Buy a Dobsonian. Now, they're not motor drive or anything. They're kind of a point and shoot, but you can get them convertible that you know breaks down into a small crate. You can slide under your bed, and then you take it out and expand it out. You have to climb a ladder to look through the ocular, but you'll be able to tell what that star is.
So it's called a Dobsonian.
Dobsonian. It's a very big mirror that gathers a lot of light, and then you can put various oculars on it or eyepieces up to boost the magnification. They're kind of a down and dirty telescope, no motor drive or any programming of any kind. You just grab the handle and point it at something using your spotting scope, and then look through the eyepiece. And you'll have to move it to keep up with the rotation of the Earth, because those stars are going to be going out of field, as he said, 15 degrees an hour. But you'll be able to look at stars and nebula and all kinds of cool stuff with a big scope like that.
Well,
you can get a really
nice one. I got one other question for you, Brooks. Just off the subject, but it's still something very interesting. Is what's the time of going to an Earth expedition?
The Arctic expedition is next August, a year from this month, The plans are still going forward. So it's still a go. And we're still on a mission of discovery. It's not that we believe in a hollow Earth or anything like that, but we're going up there because nobody's gone before, and we're just going to gather the data and see what we can see.
Well, I wish you luck, and I definitely want to be taking, just focusing on that also. Thanks a lot, and you guys have a nice night.
Thanks, Will. Have a great week. Okay, Tom, we'll get back to these the artificial structure. We were talking about the face on Mars, and it's been talked about by other personalities out there, but no one is eminently qualified to talk about the science of it than you are. So let's see what we can do in the next 10 minutes.
Okay. Well, it's obvious to every scientist and probably to most civilians, too, that you can see faces in clouds and faces in natural terrain. You can see tricks of light and shadow and in mountains and so on. The difference is that faces that are illusions like that are usually seen in two dimensions only. And if you look at them from a different angle or have the lighting from a different angle, the illusion goes away because it is an illusion. Unlike, say, the faces at Mount Rushmore, which look like faces from any viewing angle with any lighting. Well, the five or six really good faces that we've now seen on Mars, human-like faces, all have the character that they persist in appearance from any viewing angle and with any lighting conditions. So that passes that one test, suggesting that they are of a much more persistent variety than the illusions we sometimes see on Earth. However, to really do a test of artificiality, it's required that we ignore the first example, except to form hypotheses and make predictions that no one could possibly know in advance, and then see predictions that will distinguish a natural from an artificial origin, and then when the data comes in, that will tell us which is which. I always say that's sort of like if you're dealt a hand of 13 cards at, say, bridge, and it turns up to be 13 spades, the odds against that are 635 billion to one. So you say, wow, you know, that must be, there must be something funny going on to beat the odds that much. But every single hand you're dealt of 13 unique cards had the same odds against chance. So accidents can and do happen at even very large odds. On the other hand, if someone says to you, I predict that the next hand you're dealt will be 13 spades, and it is, then you know that that person had foreknowledge of how the deal was going to turn out, and that was not an accident.
That's the big difference.
That's the big difference. So predicting something in advance makes a big difference to interpreting what the result versus just stumbling on it blindly. And when we saw the face on Mars at Cydonia, and it seemed to have the impression of an eye socket, of a nose, and a possible mouth on a seemingly regular basis, predictions were made to the effect of, if and only if this was built to look like a humanoid face, when we see it close up at higher resolution, the eye socket probably should have an iris in it, and it should probably have an eyebrow over it. The nose should be tapered and should have nostrils at the end. The mouth should have parted lips. The chin should be present, and the mesa should be regular on both sides. Those are qualitative predictions. The scientists got really, really specific, and they said, all right, here's the range of size, the range of shape, the range of orientation, and the range of location that would qualify as a successful artificial attempt to portray an eyebrow or an iris or nostrils or lips. So size, shape, location, and orientation are all specified within a certain exact ranges. Anything outside that range doesn't count. So the predictions have to all come true, all four parameters for each of the features that were predicted, and there can't be a background of similar features from which we can pick and choose the ones that meet our preconceptions of a face.
Now, what are the odds of all that happening?
The odds turned out to be something on the order of 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, when high-resolution pictures did come in 1998, the famous face on Mars at Cydonia had a triangular-shaped eyebrow feature over the eye socket, an iris in the eye socket, a tapered nose, nostrils at the end of the nose, two of them just oriented just as they should be, and parted lips on a very regular mesa. All of those predictions were fulfilled, even though no one had foreknowledge of how it could turn out that way. That pattern has been repeated time and time again, and not only have the prediction tests of artificial versus natural come out, but there's another kind of test, which is the association test. Remember, I mentioned how things tend to cluster in groups.
Right.
There is another image on Mars that is hauntingly interesting because it's the faint outline of what looks like a child sitting on the ground with woolly hair, a clear face, a chest, and his legs crossed sitting on the ground. And it's faint and washed out and not impressive enough to convince anyone that it was artificial by looking at it. Even if looking was a valid criterion, which it isn't. But it's the closest thing you have to something looking like a human child anywhere in the solar system, Earth excepted, except for this one object on all of Mars. And the location of that object is right next to the face at Cydonia.
Wow.
Again, is really
amazing.
Again, association is another way of arguing for artificiality because this is accumulative evidence that chance is not the explanation. There are many other examples, too. There was a not particularly impressive pictogram of what looked like a panther turn up, except that the high-resolution image showed only the head and body, but didn't show the hindquarters. And one of the scientists said, well, it looks like a panther, but it's so easy to be fooled by things that look like something. But he said, here's the predictions. He says, if this is a natural object, when we get the high-resolution image of the area adjoining the hindquarters, he said, it'll probably be sand or craters or mountains or valleys or anything but the completion of the animal's hind leg and a tail.
Right.
But when that image came in 3 years after the prediction was made, it had a hind leg and a tail.
Wow.
Again, predicting in advance is one of the ways we distinguish natural from artificial. And when you make a prediction like that and it comes out in the surprising direction, it's just as much a bias to say, now wait a minute, that must not have been a valid test, there has to be a natural explanation, than it is to say prematurely, I'm already convinced that it's artificial. Bias, humans are tend toward biases so easily. And the goal of the scientist is to devise a test that when the protocol is followed through carefully and the results are in, they will speak for themselves and the biases of the scientist cannot possibly affect the outcome. That's the perfect test in science. When the outcome is what it is and you can't go back and say, no, wait a minute, I didn't like that outcome. That isn't the outcome that will get me more funding. That isn't the outcome I believed. I'm going to question the data. I'm going to analyze to death the data that doesn't look right, and I'll accept without checking all the data that fits my expectations. That's human humanity and the way we all tend to fool ourselves when we're something that we really want to believe in. But
oh,
the scientists,
come on, Tom. Only religions do that, right?
I'm afraid we all do that from time to time.
You have a quotation on your website from Stephen Goldberg. It says, the consequences of a claim that something is true are entirely irrelevant to the issue of whether the claim is true. So if
yes,
the claim is true, live with the consequences, people. Let's learn.
That's exactly it. And when these tests came out, it was very much, I may sound like I'm a bit of a preacher here, but
that's
I had
okay.
to face the consequences myself one day because I was a big skeptic, too, going into this. And before the high-resolution images came along, we only had these low-resolution images, and eight tests to distinguish natural from artificial turned up, and I was the author of two of them. I said, if that face was intended to be a portrayal of a humanoid face, it would have been built on the equator so it could be seen from an orbiting space station because it sure can't be seen from the ground, and it would have been built upright and not tilted over on its side. Well, neither of those was true. But a few years later, somebody pointed me to evidence that the pole on Mars had shifted with this cataclysm
90 degrees.
And when we went back to before the pole shift, there was the face right on the Martian equator and upright. 1,000 to 1
oh
odds again. And that, I had to swallow hard. It was actually almost like a state of shock for a couple of days, readjusting my internal paradigms to say, hey, wait a minute. I kept resisting that result. There must be something wrong here. And then I finally had to say, no, those are your biases speaking. The test was a clean, legitimate one. There's no reason to reject the result. The result now says at 1,000 to 1 odds, this thing is probably artificial. And
Tom, I tell you, another shock is that we have blown through another 3-hour program. We're going to have to do this again and not wait a year. And I want to start right here and carry on forward because somehow we saved the best for last both times you've been on. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. And don't forget, Earth Explorers, Crisis in Cosmology 2, if you're in the Port Angeles area of Washington State, next week?
We have welcoming on the 7th, and then the conference is the 8th through the 11th.
Very good. All right, that's one to make. Top cosmologists in the world. Going to break some new science, going to push the science in a new direction, and you can be there for that history-making event. The website, metaresearch.org, and my guest has been Tom Van Flandern. Tom, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooks. A pleasure speaking with you again tonight.
Wonderful, wonderful. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you later.
Okay, good night.
Good night. All right, Earth Explorers, that's it for August 31st, 2008. Another one in the can, and we'll talk at you next week at this time.
It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.